This episode of the Envelope Podcast is supported by Universal Pictures' Oppenheimer, written and directed by Christopher Nolan. The Washington Post calls it a masterpiece. Oppenheimer is now nominated for 13 Academy Awards, including Best Director, Christopher Nolan, Best Adapted Screenplay, and Best Picture of the Year.
Welcome to the Envelope Podcast. I'm Mark Olson.
I'm Yvonne Villarreal.
I'm Sean Finney.
And now this is the first time the three of us have been together again since the Oscar nominations happened. And, you know, Sean, this kind of phase two, the sort of post-nominations period, to you, is this like an exciting part of the year, or do you feel like the air starts going out of the balloon now?
I think it's an exciting time of the year, because I mean, there's two different phases. There's nominations, where each branch, so actors vote on actors, writers vote on writers, and then now it opens up to the entire membership. So I think with the membership growing exponentially, it's like at 11,000 now, it's the most global it's ever been. I feel like the new voices, we're starting to see that in Best Picture, and really just the nominations alone, and I'm excited. I think it's a surprising time. Anything can happen.
It's a lot of screeners to get through, though, right?
Yes, it is a lot of screeners to get through.
And now, Yvonne, you and I were actually at the Oscar nominees luncheon.
You all were at the nominee luncheon, which is one of my favorite events. Yvonne, who did you speak to?
Well, I didn't actually go inside the luncheon. I felt I was very excluded from the cool kids table there. But yes, Mark and I had a room where we were sort of doing interviews when we could get them. And I spoke with cinematographer Rodrigo Prieto, and it was amazing because when you talk about someone that can really mix it up, here you went from doing the cinematography for a film like Barbie, which is so, you know, opulent and popped with color. And then he went to something like The Killers of the Flower Moon, which is so stark and haunting. So it was nice to talk to him about, you know, switching things up, and also just his collaboration with Martin Scorsese. This is their fourth film together, and The Killers of the Flower Moon is what he's up for as a nominee. So I really enjoyed our conversation, but you, I heard, got like somebody that has delivered so many of the songs of our lives, and but you didn't sing, though.
I spoke to the Diane Warren. Her 15th nomination, she already has an honorary Oscar at home. She says the Oscar is lonely, so she's going for it again, which I'm super excited about. She's the only nomination from the film, directed by Eva Longoria, Flaming Hot. And I don't know, Diane talks to me about her process, about her life, but also just about why she still does what she does. And you know, you think about a nomination 15 times, what that takes from her very first one, and she's still just as excited. She was, I don't know if you saw the video, but she posted on her social where she's up, she's walking through her whole process. She's like, I don't sleep, I get up, I'm nervous, I'm shaking. And I'm like, wow, after it still means so much. So I love.
But you didn't have her make a theme song for this podcast. That's a missed opportunity.
Do you know what that would cost?
I have failed. I have failed us. But you know, I'm gonna call in a favor later, but she did sing acoustic. She sung to me the song acoustic, and I was like, I was trying to be cool on camera and not ugly cry. We talked about this before.
Yeah.
But I was like, it's cool, Diane. Well, this is really cool. This is really cool. So no, it was amazing. But you spoke to another dynamic force, Justine Triet.
Exactly, yeah. So Justine Triet, she's the director and co-writer of Anatomy of a Fall. You know, she's been nominated for directing, for the screenplay, and then the film has been nominated for Best Picture. And she had won the Palme d'Or at Cannes. She's one of only a few women who's won that prize. And, you know, she's been kind of like on the rise in France over the past few years. This is actually her fourth feature film, but, you know, she's relatively unknown here in the States. And so the way that she's just kind of broken through with this film, it's, you know, it's a kind of an exciting courtroom thriller. So it's like a great combination of both like a courtroom drama that sort of like American audiences can understand, but it has also like, it's set in France, and so it's there's something kind of like exciting about it and different about it too. It's just been really exciting to see her sort of like, you know, shine in the spotlight this season.
Look, this is a really fun episode for us. We got three great conversations to bring you. Stay tuned, coming up next is my interview with Rodrigo. Rodrigo, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, I know Killers of the Flower Moon was the fourth film that you've done with Martin since 2013's Wolf of Wall Street. And I know Raging Bull was such a seminal film for you. So I'm curious, what do you remember about that first ever meeting with Martin? Like, if you were recreating the moment for a movie of your life, set up the shot for me.
I think this scene, it's a good question. I think the scene would start with the little figure of Hugo, the little robot, because that's in his living room. And I remember sitting there waiting for him, and the robot, robot was there. And so I felt like the robot, you know, a little awkward and a little stiff maybe. And but immediately, as soon as Scorsese came into the room, the warmth came in with him. He was very charming, disarming. And I just felt at ease, you know. And it's also the kind of thing where you have really nothing to lose, because, you know, I didn't expect to be, you know, making movies with Martin Scorsese. It wasn't something like, yeah, that's one thing I'm going to do. That's a goal, you know. So so I had nothing to lose. But I think, yeah, the scene would be, I think the lighting would be soft. It wouldn't be warm, the color of the light, but it'd be soft and easy.
Okay.
And but the actor that plays me, I would direct him to be a little nervous and maybe say a couple of bad jokes, you know. That's sort of what I'd do.
Did you say bad jokes?
I'm sure I did. I don't remember. But
Fast forward to Killers of the Flower Moon. How has that dynamic evolved between you two? I'm sure there's still nerves, but the shorthand or the comfortability, like, and when you're first meeting for something like this project, do you dive right in, or is it sort of like we ease our way into this?
Well, you know, every movie has been very different, just thematically, but also the way we've approached it and how we've come up with the visual ideas. Mm-hmm. Killers of the Flower Moon was a film that required very deep research. Mm-hmm. All of us involved in the production really didn't know much about the Osage, or really anybody. So we listened. That was the main thing. And I observed how Scorsese was so deeply involved in learning. So I said, I'm going to do the same thing, and asked questions. And for me, it was learning how the Osage relate to their surroundings and to light. And that was an important thing that I actually incorporated into scenes with them, the sunlight, where the sunlight is, the position of the sun, photographing the sun, you know, things of that sort. So and it was a long process of experimentation with Scorsese. We tested many things visually and came up with a design very little by little, and there it is.
How is it in the moment working through something with him? Like, is he saying, okay, I'm going to be like, let's block this. I'm going to be Ernest. You're going to be Molly. Does he go in that deep, or what is the process like?
Yeah. I played Molly most of the time with him, and we play Ernest. No, he designs the shots during pre-production. He separates himself from the day-to-day moments of production for at least a week, and maybe more, sometimes 2 weeks. He sits down by himself in the hotel room and plots the shots on the script itself. He does annotations and sometimes little diagrams or drawings, and then he'll share that with myself and with the assistant director. That's kind of the first step of, it becomes my Bible in terms of what we're going to do on each scene shot-wise. Mm-hmm. It's up to me then to define the focal length, you know, and the background and, you know, the angles, but it's all based on his design. And then on set, he really is very open to what the actors are feeling and saying and doing. And we always respect that. And if an actor has an idea that maybe wasn't what we planned, usually we'll do what the actor is feeling. He's very flexible in that sense. Open to improvisation or new dialogue or, you know, whatever happens. And I think some of the most powerful moments in his movies come from that. And this wasn't the exception. There are things in the film that I love, and we weren't planning on it. And then, you know, we went that way, and there it is.
Can you give me an example of one that stands out to you, or that you really were like, I don't know about this, but it turned out to be?
Yes.
Yeah,
tell yes. me. Well, There's the moment after the explosion of Rita and Bill's house. We go back to the house. Ernest now is going to deliver the news of what happened. He knew that something like this was going to happen, but he didn't expect the extent of it. And now he's really feeling the confusion and the guilt. So the shot that Scorsese had designed was going in through the doorway and then the porch, you know, going into the house and finding the family, finding Molly and the kids and the nanny and maybe in the living room.
Right.
So I prepared for that. I lit the living room, the dining room, you know, the And so when we're getting ready for it, he asks, he actually asked, you know, Ernest was there, Molly, and everybody was there. He asked her, so where would you be, Molly? You know, in this case, we use the names of the characters. And she said, I'd probably be in a basement. And we pivoted, and that became the shot. So now we go into the house through the living room, dining room, into the kitchen, and the door opens, and we see down the stairs into the basement. And it became a very powerful image.
Mm-hmm.
It just composition-wise, seeing her down there and the depth of that, and also the feeling of vulnerability and of them being in this refuge, and then seeing Ernest up there delivering, it became very powerful. And that was, it just came out of what she was feeling at the moment.
Is there a tell when Martin is like, I like where this is going? Does he have a quirk or that lets you know we're onto something?
Yeah. I mean, it's just an energy, right? That you have a feeling that he's in the zone.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of times it'll be his laughter. I mean, certainly not in that scene that I just described, but when he laughs, you know that he's happy, okay. You know, and that things are working, and you know, and he relaxes, and it's pretty wonderful when that starts happening. I mean, certainly there was a lot of laughter on Wolf of Wall Street,
right.
But there was also tension. You know, there was every day in the morning, especially, we're all like, what's going to happen today? And once it starts flowing, then he laughs.
I imagine there's a lot of intimacy that develops between you and the actors because you're watching their performances in such like a close way. It's private and intimate what you're seeing. I'm curious, like seeing someone like Robert and Leonardo through the years, or even Lily for the first time, what struck you in sort of seeing their performances so closely?
Yeah, certainly with the DiCaprio and De Niro, we've done other projects beforehand, and seeing their transformation, first of all, the physical transformation, mm-hmm. was startling. Of course, we shot tests, and you know, you kind of know what's going to happen, roughly.
Yeah.
But then on set, when the environment is there, and the production design, and lighting, it's pretty amazing. And also to witness their process, how they get into the characters is fascinating, and how it starts building, you know. And with Lily, it was, I didn't know her. And to find what Molly became and see her also find that, and it really transformed the way we photographed her even. We realized how she was the center of gravity of all this, just the way she was doing it. So we started framing her more centered, literally more symmetrical frames, and it wasn't really planned that way, but that's the way it evolved. Mm-hmm. Just responding from her performance.
What's it like watching Robert in action as somebody that really admired something like Raging Bull?
Yes.
Are you still like Mr. De Niro, or do you have like, do you feel a comfortability there?
Still Mr. De Niro, but I feel definitely a level of comfort. And you know, we've also coincided in some of the Q&As and that sort of thing. And I mean, it's still to me amazing to be friendly with these people that have been my heroes for so long. In fact, when we were doing The Irishman, it was my birthday, and my wife, she got a poster of Raging Bull, and had them all sign it, and Pesci and De Niro. And it was really, so it's one of my treasured belongings.
Well, something that's so impressive about the work that you do is you can go from something that's, you know, stark and haunting like Killers of the Flower Moon to something that's so excessive and bright and vibrant like Barbie. Is the contrast of that something that you really like sort of exploring, or is it jarring to go from something like that to something like that?
Well, I think that it's like in life itself. There's so many different emotions that we go through, so many different moments. Mm-hmm. And I love being able to explore that through cinema as well. Mm-hmm. We can be very sad one moment and joyful and laughing even the next moment. And right. And having the opportunity to work with these incredible directors and photograph such diverse worlds and points of view also. And for me, getting to understand, or trying to understand, how a director sees this story that we're working on, and then me becoming those eyes in a way, and how do I translate the way they see it, or the way I understand that they're seeing it, mm-hmm. to the screen. You know, it's kind of my responsibility to put everybody's work onto the screen. So I really actually enjoyed very much doing different genres and jumping from one thing to something radically different.
What was the gap between those? Is it hard to transition out of one to the other, or does it sort of reset right away?
It was pretty immediate. I was in Killers of the Flower Moon, and some of the weekends before we started shooting, I was doing Zooms with Greta Gerwig and, you know, talking about the look of it. So I had to switch to that. I had to, you know, because I was so obviously in Osage country, and, you know, and then suddenly, okay, so what does Barbie Land look like? You know, so it was a little jarring. And finally, I had to tell Greta, okay, now we have to stop talking about Barbie, and I'm sorry, I have to concentrate on this, and you'll see when I'm doing Barbie, that's all that's going to be in my mind. And but right now it's Killers of the Flower Moon. So yeah, and then I finished that and almost immediately I think flew to London to start prepping Barbie, and it felt easy actually, you know, because I already had it sort of thought out, and then going into it, it was just, I don't know, it's been that way in most of my career, and I guess I'm kind of used to it too.
Does a collaboration with Greta feel any different than a collaboration with Martin? How are they similar or different in their work process?
Yeah, it's very different. Every director has a complete different set of even dogmas, if you may, or things that have to be a certain way. And I love navigating that. I think the common part of them, both of them, is just the joy and love of cinema in general. They love movies. And they also love making movies. Mm-hmm. So that makes the work very enjoyable, because you know that it's not just work. You know, it's not something that, okay, I'm going to get paid for this, it's a job. You know, it's something that they're passionate about. And I feel very fortunate to work with them. Also, there's just this thing about noise that's very different. Scorsese is very sensitive to noise. Mm-hmm. So especially in the morning when he arrives, things have to be quiet, so that he can concentrate, you know, talk with the actors, look at the monitor. Everybody has to be totally quiet.
Okay.
And Greta's the opposite. She likes noise. She actually likes it. She's told me that when she's writing, for example, she has to be in a cafeteria or in a place where there's noise. That way she can concentrate. So it's really interesting how it's, and both ways work. You know, it's fine.
How are you as a director? You've just done your first feature film. Talk to me about that and what you discovered about yourself as a director, and also how you collaborate with a cinematographer.
Yeah. Well, I discovered that I'm pretty intense. And but I do bring many of the things that I've learned from all the directors that I've worked with. Unconsciously even, some of the shot design ideas and some of the explorations I've done before with other directors. In fact, I showed a cut of the film, Pedro Páramo was the title, to Scorsese the other day. And that was scary, but... but he enjoyed it. And I suddenly said, I didn't even mention to him, there's some shots in the movie that are certainly inspired on things that he's done, or that, you know, and they're homages to... So I asked him, he didn't even like, he didn't realize, you know, he was involved in the film but he gave me some very, very specific editorial notes, which were awesome. Like, oh, you should keep this shot 20 frames longer, things like that. And so I did it, of course.
Before I let you go, I know film for you was something that took hold at a very early age with monster films and you and your brother creating stuff. I'm curious, can you tell me can you still picture that image that first captured your attention on film?
The skeleton fight in Jason and the Argonauts. You'll have to look it up.
Okay, I'm going to.
It's incredible. Okay. And that for me was just magic and cinema. And I knew, as a child, how they did it, because I was already doing, you know, clay monsters and stop motion, and it was stop motion. I kind of knew rear screen projection, you know, how do they put these skeletons with the people? And, you know, it was just magical.
I love that. Well, Rodrigo, thanks so much for taking the time. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Likewise. Thank you so much.
Coming up after the break, Sean's interview with Diane Warren.
Welcome to The Envelope. My name is Sean Finney, and today's guest is the Diane Warren. She is a pioneer of music and architect of music, film, and cinema and culture, and someone I love very, very much. 15 nominations, 7 consecutive years, and this year she is nominated for her song Fire Inside from Flaming Hot. Welcome, Diane Warren.
Great to see you, Sean. I'm a pioneer, though. I came in a covered wagon.
No, you are a pioneer.
With a keyboard.
You're making it happen, Diane. But Diane, you know, when we think about these big stats and all these records and history that you've made and broken, it can't think about that without young Diane.
I still feel like I'm young Diane.
No, you are young Diane. But young Diane and Van Nuys growing up.
Right.
What does all of this mean now for you? Like Diane, who was watching the Oscars with her family,
Diane, who was watching
Born Free and seeing a film for the first time. Talk to me about that.
I mean, the fact that I was that kid, like every year watching it and crying when I saw heard songs and movies like Born Free, and the fact that This was my dream to be a songwriter. Like I didn't know anybody. I'm from Van Nuys. My dad sold insurance. You know, I mean, but it's like it's kind of cool the songs this year with the fire inside, because it is the fire inside that drives you. And I had that from an early age, that I had that fire to be a songwriter and to succeed in it and to be great in it. And it wasn't just a dream that I worked my ass off. I just, every day, you know, when I was about 14, I was like, I'm not doing anything else. I mean, I got, you know, straight D's and F's in school until there's a guitar out there, a 12-string guitar that my dad bribed me with, that if I got nothing less than C's, he'd get me a Martin 12-string guitar. I did get that, and I did get nothing less than a C, and right back to F's and D's right after that, but I got my guitar. It was all good. And I just put in the work, and, you know, I would read Billboard every day, you know, every week. You know, I made my dad get me a subscription, you know. So it was always about music and songs, and I always loved movies, so it's such a natural thing to do.
When did you understand the music and the business and film, that intersection between?
I don't know if I ever understood it, just something that kind of happened, you know. Like my first nominated song was a movie called Mannequin, you know, about a guy who basically a mannequin, let's be real. it's one of those guilty pleasures, but you know, and it was kind of cool to write that. Well, actually, my first hit really was Rhythm of the Night, which was from Berry Gordy's The Last Dragon.
Yep.
So that my first big hit happened to be from a movie. So it kind of did all kind of come together. And then I realized, you know, I was good at it. You know, my dad said he'd put me through support me if I went to college. So I went to Cal State Northridge, and I took nothing but film classes because I could just watch movies. I wouldn't have to do anything.
Yeah.
So I wasn't really a music major. I would just break into the piano rooms and teach myself piano. But I would watch all these movies, and then maybe subliminally, you know, that kind of taught me, because I was hearing songs, I was hearing music, and I had to sit there, you know, and. You know what I mean? So kind of like, I think I was prepared. A lot of this is dream meets the work meets the preparation, you know? And then you create, you know, yourself. You create your own luck from that. I truly believe that, you know?
And one thing you've always not been shy about is just talking about the hard work.
Oh, yeah.
People are just like, it's hard work.
I'm the hardest worker that I know,
yeah.
You know? Like, I show up, you know, I'm there at 9 o'clock. I go to work every day. You know, I try to take part of Sunday off, you know? But I love my job, so it's not like I hate going to work. You know,
and you're moved by inspiration.
Oh yeah,
when you feel it.
Yeah, I was working on a song right before I got here. And I'm on the bridge of the song. And I have to go back to it after. But yeah, I love it. It's like you have a puzzle. You have to. Mm-hmm. It's like when you start a song, there's the perfect version of that song. You just have to find it. You know, and that's kind of the fun.
And what I love, Diane, is that I know that, like, when people think, "Oh, nominated 15 times," you're just kind of like, "Oh, okay, so this probably doesn't even excite you anymore."
No,
it's the complete. It for you.
No,
I know for you it is still. So just talk to me about it now, still when it's nominations morning.
So okay, well, let's talk about nomination the night before.
Yeah.
So a bunch of my friends come over.
Yep.
And we just have pizza. Just a bunch of people come by, and the crazy ones stay up all night. So I'm like, I'm not cool enough. I know people go, yeah, go to sleep. Didn't go to sleep. Let's just keep it real, man. You didn't sleep at all. If you had a potential of being nominated, you were up like I was. I'm not cool enough to lie. So I stay up all night, mm-hmm. and I'm like so nervous. And we're just trying to, you know. Okay, let's eat. Okay, let's watch a movie. Okay, let's. And then when it gets to be about 4 o'clock, it's like, it's like.
It's coming.
No, it's in an hour. Oh no, it's a half hour. Like literally, you're counting the minutes. So I love it. I and honestly, for me, that's when I win. I already won.
Talk to me about that, because I know you put that in your speech, too.
I mean this from my heart.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's only five songs chosen every year.
Yep.
There's hundreds of songs in movies every year.
Yep.
We're not the Oscars are not the Grammys.
Exactly.
You know, you'll watch the Grammys, you know, you're going to see, you know, 30 song categories.
Yep.
Right? Oscars have one. Yeah. Hundreds of songs. If you look to see who's in the music branch of voters,
yep.
The best of the best of the best. Not in America, but on the planet.
In the world,
in the
yes.
world. So they're the best composers, they're the best songwriters, you know, the best music editors. Or they're just the best at what they do.
Yeah.
They choose me, choose my song, I've won.
Already.
That's respect from people I respect. And that's everything. Now, would my honorary Oscar like a friend? Yeah, he would. You know, it kind of bums me out because I'm not enough for him. You know, he's like...
I mean, I want to talk about that because I know that for you, your process is different for every song, every project, but
yeah.
Specifically talking about Flaming Hot. When did you know, when do you decide at this point in your career, like, I want to do this, I want to jump in this?
Well, if it's something that I think I can, you know, do something great for, I get yeah. involved. And what it was, Devon Franklin
yes.
and I worked on Breakthrough. I did the song, I'm Standing With You. And we were in Nashville with Chrissy Metz, and we were in the car, and he goes, yeah, I'm working on this movie about the guy who came up with Flamin' Hot Cheetos. I was like, really? A movie about Flamin'? And he goes, no, this is a janitor. He told me the whole story. And I was really intrigued. And he goes, I'm trying to get Eva Longoria the job. And then I found out Eva Longoria got the job, and she moved into my building.
Oh.
So I would see her. I go, so I want to do the song. I want to do the song. She'd go, you know, there's not a script yet. You know, we're still working on it. Okay, tell me when. I was kind of annoying her. And stuff, and you know, and then finally there was something to see. She goes, I really want to show it to you, and I saw like a rough cut of the
yeah.
movie, and I just loved it.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, I wish it got nominated for more stuff because especially for Eva, she did such
an incredible job. For this to be her first film, like directorial
yeah.
debut, an incredible
it's
job,
fantastic.
Incredible story.
You know, it's interesting that my first nominated song is Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now.
Yes,
and this song, The Fire Inside, basically is Nothing's Gonna Stop Me Now.
Yes.
Nothing's Gonna Stop You Now.
Yes.
You know, when you have that fire. But so anyways, I saw the rough cut of the movie and I wrote down the title, The Fire Inside. I thought, that's a really good title, you know, because it's the
Flaming
double.
Flaming Hot,
yeah,
Fire Inside.
The fire inside you get when you eat them.
Yeah.
You know, but what The Fire Inside is passion. That song is about passion. And that's what I took away from this movie, that here's somebody that came from nothing. He had everything against him,
yeah.
you know, and rose to the heights he rose and created like a multi-billion dollar product by sheer will and sheer chutzpah, you know, and I related to him. And so as I'm writing the song for this movie, I'm like, wow, I'm kind of writing about me too. So it was like a really easy song to write.
Which I think is great, because I know you've also said like sometimes every song that you write, like, is not always about you, right? It's about like,
yeah.
it's your imagination.
Oh, yeah,
so
yeah.
This one is so connected to the beginning of your Oscar
yeah.
journey
yeah.
and then to this one. What have yeah. you learned, Diane, about yourself from that first nomination to 15?
I mean, I just learned that no one can stop me. or that when I believe in something, whether it's a song, you know, a song or something, like my belief is fierce.
Yeah.
It's a fire. I have the fire inside. It's what drove me to be successful. It's what drives me every day. I have that. And if you talk to Eva,
yeah.
she'll go, because she goes, yeah, we're all Richard Montanez. We all created you. We're sitting
yeah.
here. You created yourself. We
yeah.
all create ourselves because we have a dream and we have that fire and we worked to make it real. So this story, you know, back to the movie, this
yeah.
story really, really touched me and really, I really related to it. And yes, I'm writing the song for the movie, but as I'm writing the song, I'm going, you know, you know,
I relate
nothing
to
can
this.
Hold you back. No one can kill your vibe when you got the fire inside. Yeah.
You see that guy right there?
With that wapo right there? Yeah, I see him.
Yeah, you do? You see a good man?
Count
a special
me.
Man? Because baby, that's what I see. I see a chingon, a Montañez.
Yo soy Montañez.
They're scared. Scared of what you can do for them. Scared that they've been begging for help and they got a broke Mexican kid from Huasti as their hero. They don't know what to do with that.
Diane, when do you know a song is done?
It tells me.
Hmm.
It tells me.
Talk me through
it.
That a little bit. I'm curious.
You know, when I'm writing something, you know, a song tells me. I'm rewriting while I'm writing, so I never really go back and change a lot of stuff. And this song I knew had to be reggaeton. I really wanted, it wasn't going to be the big ballad. It was this song had to move. you know. So I programmed a cool drum beat that I loved, and I kind of came up with that chorus really fast. You know, nothing holds you back. No one can kill your vibe when you got the fire inside. Oh, you're gonna own this life when you got the fire inside. You know, I'm like, ooh, I got something here. I loved it. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm like, okay, how do I get there? So first line was, oh, you got places to go. You're not going there slow. It's like, okay, get that opening line. Opening lines are super important to me, you know.
So when you get the opening line, it helps you kind of narrate the rest of the story.
Yeah, then I knew where I was going. I knew what the story was, but, you know, people tell me they wake up to the song.
Yes.
It's their wake-up song. I'm like, yeah.
In the gym.
Yeah.
It goes hard in the gym, by the way.
That's what I heard. I love that.
It goes hard in the gym. And then talk to me about your collaboration with Becky G.
Yeah, so when I do a song for a movie, I'm a casting director. Mm-hmm. So that artist has to be obviously authentic to the song. They have to be able to sing it. But she's also authentic to the movie.
Yeah.
She's also Mexican.
Yeah.
And she also came from nothing. She lived in, you know, South LA and became a star because she had the fire inside. You know, as a kid, she just worked and worked. I wasn't in the studio with Becky until she was done with the vocal. And I remember going to the studio and like being blown away, but there's a couple of notes that I kind of wanted to change. And I'm glad she didn't change them because what she did was cooler.
Yeah.
There's a note in the chorus. I'm like, can you? And I don't think she, you know, I think she loved it as it was, and she was right. It's great, and I was so excited. And Eva was on a Zoom, so we were all, and Devon was there. We were all listening, and it was fun.
Diane, and your luck has not run out, and I don't see it running out. No, it's not running out anytime soon. And I'm curious because you are somebody who has said, I'm an opportunist in the most positive way, and I believe Richard is an opportunity. And just talk me through that, because I feel like this film really centers around him, like you said, when he called the CEO and he was like, I'm taking this opportunity to tell you my idea.
Yeah, okay, being an opportunist in the right way, that means grabbing every opportunity. It might not come again, and it's there, it's up to you. If you lose that opportunity, it's your fault that you lost that opportunity. Yet if you take it, you grab it and you run with it, you never know what can happen. Beautiful things happen from that.
When you said that when you were younger growing up that you had saw a record and you had saw the name in parentheses and you wanted
Goff
to be in the
King
name.
Goff and King up on the roof. And I saw that. I still remember. I want to be in the parentheses. I don't want to be the singer. Well, good, because I suck. But I don't want to be the artist. But like, yeah, I want to be that little, back in those days, kids, when they were
records are these things that
they're these round things.
But your name is no longer in parentheses. Your name is a standalone name
itself. I don't know, but thank you.
15 Oscar nominations, 7 consecutive years,
cool.
An honorary Oscar.
Yeah, that was awesome. That was the best night of my life.
You are
that was
continuing.
Cool.
Cher.
I know. Cher, who doesn't do a lot for a lot of people, but she did that for me.
With the fire inside.
When you got the fire inside. You want to hear a bit of it?
I want to hear a bit of it.
Want to hear it sung really bad?
I want to hear it sung really well.
If you want to hear a verse and chorus of the fire inside sung really badly, here you go. Oh, you got places to go. You're not going this slow. Oh, no, 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 no. They will tell you you're crazy. They will call you a fool. They will think they can stop you, but there's no stopping you. They can't put out what you got inside you. No way to put out that flame. Nothing can hold you back. No one can kill your vibe. That's right. When you got the fire inside, when you got the fire inside, and oh, you're gonna own this. You got the fire, you got the fire. Oh, the fire, oh, fire. You got the fire inside. You got the fire inside of you.
Coming up next, Mark's interview with Justine Triet.
For the Los Angeles Times and The Envelope, I'm Mark Olson. And I'm here today with Justine Triet, director and co-writer of the film Anatomy of a Fall. Justine, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you to invite me.
And now it's been not even quite a year since Anatomy of a Fall first premiered at Cannes. And in that time, you won the Palme d'Or at Cannes. It has been nominated for 11 César Awards, 5 Oscars, 7 BAFTAs. You won 2 Golden Globes. What what has this year been like?
It was really, really new for me. Everything was new. I traveled a lot. I was always in different countries. And I think it's really, really amazing what's... Yes, all the things for the movie, of course. And now for me, it's not my movie, you know. It's not mine now. It's belongs yes to the others, you know. So yes, it's fantastic, of course.
And now, why do you think audiences have responded to Anatomy of the Fall in the way that they have? Like, why this movie?
I imagine now, because 1 year after, it's, you know, the core of the movie. It's really the reciprocity between women and men. And I think it's really the core of the movie. And it's so universal and so contemporary in a way, because, of course, we are obsessed by this really simple question, just how we can live together and how we can just, you know, this thing is really important in my movie. And I flip the genre, the women and the men and the code. And I think it's, you know, for the spectator, it's a little it's a provocation for me, of course, to put that woman in that situation, because all the time it's the man.
That's why there's an investigation for a more suspicious death, because you were the only person there, and of course you're his wife.
Stop. I did not kill him.
That's not the point.
But do you think when you were making the film, in particular when you and Arturo were writing the film, you wrote it with your partner, Arturo Harari, did you realize that you were exploring something so elemental that was going to like tap into something inside of people in such a like a just a really primal way?
Yes, in a way. When we wrote this movie, we were blind in a way, because we had just some intuitions. It's like a painter, you know. But we knew that the core would be the couple and all these things. But I think we didn't have all, you know, the keys before. But yes, of course. When I started, I was obsessed by this. I said to Arthur, okay, I want to do another movie about the couples, but I want to do it. We need to have the time to dive in all this craziness. And so I didn't know exactly all the things, but of course I had some intuitions, of course. Now, the only thing that we were very, very blind, it was just because we didn't realize exactly that we were a couple and we were doing just a crazy script about couples. And so this thing in particular, we were a little blind in a way, because I think if we knew exactly, maybe we would be so afraid of this, you know, because it was like just put their hands in a very, very strange, weird bath. I don't know. And, you know, we have to live with our monsters after. It's not the end, at the end, you know. So after we dream about, we made some nightmares. So sometimes I would like, why we are doing this? Maybe I just want to make a comedy again, you know, because I love so much to write comedies, you know, and I used to do it before. So sometimes I was afraid of this movie, you know, but at the end it was so beautiful. And now it's a fairy tale, of course, because it's we share everything. So it's not our crazy baby, you know.
Because your films up until now, taken together, they're kind of in different genres. They're each sort of in its own style. But the thing that I think does connect the films is that they're all essentially exploring just what it's like to be a woman in the modern world. And does that sound right to you? Like, for you, is that the thing that you think you've been exploring in your work, like, if you take it all together?
Yes, and to show in a way how women are complex, and to not reduce them to just one thing or another, you know, to just say, oh, it's so complicated to have babies or to have a work and to, you know, and to just be in just to switch in this place or this place. So Yeah, of course. And but it's always different. But I need all the time to find a way to enjoy myself differently. And you know, the famous sentence from François Truffaut in France, who said all the time, okay, I'm doing a movie against the previous one, you know. And for me, it's really important for me, this sentence, because I feel very close to this. And all the time when I'm finished something, I'm very tough with myself. I'm very criticize with myself. And I want to just to dive in another genre, in a way, to find something new. But of course, the topics are similar, you know.
As I've heard you talking about the movie, I've always been so struck by, when you're talking about Sandra Hüller's character, that you did not want her to seduce the other characters in the movie, or in some ways the audience watching the movie. And I've heard you use this phrase that you did not want her to be a perfect victim. And can you talk a little bit more about that?
Coming up next, Mark's interview.
What you mean by that, and what you liked about having your main character be in some ways so remote to the audience.
Okay.
It's an obsession since a long time ago, because my first short movie, people said, "Oh, your main character is not sympathetic," you know. So it's a long story for me. But you know, I grew up with all these men's lead part, and sometimes they were sympathetic, sometimes not, and I felt so close to them, you know. And I think, yes, for this woman, it was really important to say, okay, she's not perfect. She's not a perfect mother. It's a paradox in a way, because she's really ungraspable in a way in the movie, but in the same way, she's playing like, you know, she's playing this like, okay, I'm sincere. I'm just, you know, there is no filter between me and you. And of course, because she's a storyteller and she's a writer, you can imagine that she could manipulate you, of course.
And I'm on camera.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Okay. I'm sorry, but
thank you for listening.
You come here, okay, with your maybe your opinion, and you tell me who
Samuel
was. It's just.
Thank you for listening and watching. Please subscribe wherever you listen and watch your podcast. We will be back next week around the Oscars.
I mean, sometimes a couple.
Thank you for listening and watching.
Kind of
please subscribe wherever you listen and watch your podcast.
You don't know if she's just like you and me, or if she's really good in just telling stories, you know.
I've heard you talk as well about how you've grown increasingly to want a sense of imperfection and a sense of almost chaos in your movies and from the performers. And can you talk a little bit more about that? What is it that you like about not trying to make the movies more perfect, but in some ways trying to bring out the imperfections in the movie?
Yeah. I think, you know, when we've searched for money in France to build all the things. It was the first time in my life that all the people were very, very happy with the script. I don't speak about the cast, but the script was really, we were very happy with this. So when I came on set, I was very afraid of this, because I think when you are really good with a script, it could be very dangerous, because after, you just do the things and it could be very cold at the end. It means to destroy a little the little music, perfect music, of course, of all the lights and all the things with my DP, and it was not so easy, you know, because sometimes my team was like, I don't understand, why do you want some blurry things? Why do you want to not be, you know, to not do a perfect picture? And I was like, because I think we have to find a charm, you know? And Sandra was so special, because she was so, yes, she was very, very involved. So I was like, okay, we have to find a way to create some accidents, and to not create, but sometimes to grab all the accidents. And sometimes it was really, really something, because sometimes I was like, okay, we are going in editing, we are going to take the most ugly takes. Sometimes it creates something, you know?
When you won the Palme d'Or at Cannes, you gave a speech in which you spoke about the protests that have been happening in France at the time against the Macron government. You talked about the situation involving funding of films and cultural production, in particular for younger and emerging filmmakers. What made you want to give that speech? I mean, you really took that moment for the sort of like, you grabbed that platform, and what made you want to make those comments at that moment?
Because I think that when I started in the business, it was not the same world. It was much more easy for people like me. I did not do, a classical school to make that job. I was really, and I think my speech was really for the youth, the young generation, and to say, just please, I had the privilege to just start it in a different world. Please keep all these things for the young generation. It was very important for me. And after this, you don't know, but a lot of people say to me, oh, thank you so much to just think about us, and to not just because all the story of France is built on the idea of to not be forced to just do a movie to just win money, you know?
But were you surprised by the response to your speech? Because at least from the news reports here in America, there was very controversial. There was some amount of backlash against you. Some people even think that this is why Anatomy of a Fall was not selected to represent France for the international feature at the Academy Awards.
Yes, it's really weird. And now people talk. So I think, yes, of course, it was obviously a backlash, how do you say? Yeah. Yes, of course.
You regret it? Or do you feel like you would
never, because I think the most precious thing for me is to be free to talk. I'm an artist, I'm not a politician, you know, and if I cannot speak like this in a democracy, I don't know, it's not possible. It's my power, it's my superpower. So I'm so happy, and I cannot regret this. I was not super happy of the answer, of course, because I would have loved to represent the France, and but I think it's not good for their image now, because a lot of things comes out and a lot of people talk about it, and of course a lot of American people criticize the French reaction. So I think at the end it's a happy end in a way. I don't know, we will see on the Oscar.
And now just the last thing I want to ask you, Justine, is you recently, it was announced that you'd signed with the American agency CAA.
Yeah.
And I'm so curious, what's next for you? I mean, do you want to make a film fully in English with, you know, American actors, or for you in particular, you know, signing with an American agency, what does that mean to you? What do you plan to do next?
I would love to work with American actors, and maybe to mix with French actors. I don't know exactly. It depends of the movie, but I would love, of course. And I did two movies with in mixing some different languages, and I love so much to do this. And yes, I would love, of course, to work with. It's all my a huge part of my cinephilie. I don't know how to say. Comes from your country, so of course it's a fairy tale for me in a way. To just have the capacity of meeting them, and of course to maybe can dream about a project with them, of course, yeah. But I'm sorry, I don't have the next project.
I know, we can't wait to find out what exactly will come next. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you for listening and watching. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcast. We will be back next week with more to come around the Oscars.